Welcome, Capital Raisers. We are back from our holiday vacations and ready to take on 2023. Are you guys ready to raise? On today's show, we talked to Stephen Pesavento about thought leadership, scaling into commercial real estate syndications, and investor mindset. We also talk about vetting sponsors and portfolio management philosophy. If you would like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on Capital Raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raisers Show, episode 245, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Steve Pesavento on the Capital Raisers Show, season 3, man. Now brought to you by Pitch Six. How the heck are you, brother?
I'm doing phenomenal. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Dude. Man, I've heard your name around for some time now. I've been interested in meeting you for whatever reason. Same thing with Bronson Hill, man. We just never came across each other. And he introduced us, so props to him for doing that, man. But really excited to dive into all kinds of stuff, business, capital raising, marketing, spirituality, travels, snowboarding possibly. So we'll see where this conversation goes. As I was telling you before, man, we don't have a preset kind of questioning, but the show can go in a variety of directions. So hopefully we'll create some good content for the listeners. And for those of them that have never heard of you, Stephen, tell us a little bit about your background, my friend. How did you get into this thing called capital raising and syndicating commercial real estate?
For those of you who don't know, welcome to getting out from under that rock you've been living under. But my name is Stephen Pesavento, been operating full-time in the real estate world since 2016. When I was a kid, I wanted to do one of two things. I either wanted to be a chef like Emeril Lagasse, or I wanted to renovate property like Bob Vila. I'll tell you, after all of that Food Network and HGTV, one of them finally paid off because bought and flipped over 200 houses before we transitioned into multifamily, own 10 properties. Von Finch is an investment manager and sponsor. We're actively operating deals. We've gone through a variety of different strategies to be able to grow to the company that we are today. So happy to talk a lot about that. Happy to talk about marketing and sales and speaking and teaching and building a thought leadership platform, because the Investor Mindset Show has been around since 2019, was new and noteworthy for 6 months, top 1,000 podcasts for 2 years. And we've had over 1 million downloads or listens, and we keep growing. And it's the number one tool that has allowed us to build relationships at scale and really build the company that people know today as Von Finch Capital. So excited to be here, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and great to have you. How did you learn to create a thought leadership platform? So for me, I read Joe Fairless's book, The Best Ever Apartment Syndication book, and went right to the capital raising chapter, and it's all thought leadership, interview-based thought leadership platform. So I'm like, okay, let's do one. So how did you know to do this?
I think that's so great. It's such a powerful tool when used well. I think a lot of people are jumping on board, but it really takes that consistency. It takes finding what you're the best at. And so if we go back, 2014, I previously worked in management consulting, worked in big Fortune 500 companies across Minneapolis. I ended up finding my way out of that space because I just realized there was such a lack of passion. So I moved into high growth startups, moved out to Boulder, Colorado. There's a very large startup community there, started working in software development and managing developer teams. And of course, doing growth marketing, which is just a fancy word of marketing for startups. And in that space, I learned so much about digital marketing, learned about customer acquisition. I learned about this term called growth hacking, which is just a fancy way of saying trying a bunch of different things scientifically until you figure out which of those strategies worked. And so during that time, I had built up a bunch of different skills, had launched a startup, failed, launched another company, failed, eventually launched Von Finch Capital. And where we started on the home side, we were going direct to seller. So we were sending 100,000 mailers a month, cold calling, text message, you name it. Every single one of those 200 homes that we bought were bought directly from homeowners. And so when we transitioned from Von Finch Homes and buying those individual properties, we exited that portfolio and we were making our move into buying larger assets, we thought we could just leverage some of those same strategies. So we can talk about that. There are some lessons learned on that. But simultaneously, going back to 2014, when I first heard the Tim Ferriss podcast, I can directly link a big part of my success to listening to Tim Ferriss and Tony Robbins early, changing my mindset from growing up in a broke household where money was nothing but issues and pain and fighting and all this BS was going on. And I just made a decision really early that I was never going to live like that. I was not going to have kids and be poor. So I was kind of on this constant mission of figuring out a way to make money and enjoy the process of doing it. But at that time, when I wanted to launch a podcast and I thought that would be really amazing back in 2014, I didn't think I had any skills. I didn't think I had something that I could bring to people. And I was so wrong. If I would have came out with the same show at the same time, that type of early mover's advantage is huge. But even starting the podcast 3 years ago was still early compared to what we're at in the last 12 to 24 months. But I'll tell you what happened. I was at an event, was doing personal development. It's a big thing. Big part of my life is continuously learning to grow and being surrounded by people with bigger and better belief systems. And I'm sitting at this event and I leave it and it's transformational. And I come home and I had made a decision that I was going to start a show in the next 12 months, that I was not going to let my fear of maybe not having the skills or being an expert enough in anything in particular to stop me. And it was between changing that belief, making that decision, and then going to another conference and meeting people that I had listened to their podcast. And I realized that they knew nothing about what they were talking about, but people looked up to them as if they were a thought leader. I realized, well, I have respect for this person, but if they can do it, I can do it because I have way more experience in this space, buying and renovating and doing this kind of volume of real estate. I came to that with a different mindset. And so that's really where the investor mindset was born. It was born out of this seeking to bring two passions together, a passion for changing a set of beliefs, and we all have them, we all need to change them, and for what real estate and specifically investing in real estate can do for somebody. That's how it was born.
That's fantastic. So I want to dive into something that you talked about. I think you even said, hey, maybe we can or should chat about this, which is like the capital raising in the early days when you were doing the single family. I'm sure you had some effective things that were working that maybe did not transition when you got into larger scale syndications or multifamily assets or whatever commercial real estate you were doing. What were those? Can you talk to us about how you were raising capital in the early days and what you found out along the way when you transitioned into commercial real estate?
Well, that's what's so interesting. Buying 200 homes at about an average of like $300,000, $350,000 per home. Some were $1 million homes, some were $250,000 homes. We had to raise all of that money. At the time, even coming from the career and background I did, I didn't have a huge chunk of money to really invest in the business. I built the business on debt. I built the business on money I did not have, on a belief of what I could build. At times, I often hear people complain saying, well, I can't invest in my business. I don't have any money. It's like, well, you have to find a way to either make money or you have to find a way to get money in order to grow your business. So I started my original business on debt, marketing to folks, putting in my sweat to build equity, to eventually raise money, to get a few individual private investors to have a belief. And I also partnered and brought on a very experienced operator who had flipped many homes, but he didn't have a pipeline of going out and getting deals. So I was able to sell his background and track record to these lenders in order to get some of those early loans, some of those early, that early equity to be able to buy those individual properties. So that's where it started. And raising equity and raising debt for single family is different than when you get into the multifamily world. But one thing that's very different is that you're not going to be able to go buy a 200 unit building directly from the seller with the same strategies that you would going and buying a single family home. Sure, it's possible. And theoretically, it does happen from time to time. But for the most part, brokers are holding the keys to those large assets. So that was one thing that I did not know when I first came into the business. I thought, oh, I can apply the same skill on acquisitions here. And you can in the 40 to 80 unit range, you can get some value. But even in that range, there's a group of brokers who are calling these people every single day, telling them they can get more money than they really can in order to win that person's business. So it's during this exact same time that I realize that this investor mindset podcast that I launched is also an asset. I was doing it for fun. I had not set this up as a tool of thought leadership. I had not set this up as a tool to raise money. I had really set this up because I was passionate about it, because I enjoyed it, because I liked interviewing super successful people and pulling out the way that they think and being able to share that with people. That was where the show started, and that's where that passion was. But interestingly enough, the people listening to the show over time got to know who I was deep down. They got to see me grow as an individual, as an interviewer. They got to hear about when I had a huge loss of somebody really close to me in my life. They got to experience some of my life through the conversations that I'm having and through the lessons that I'm learning. And we, what's called a parasocial relationship. It's a one to many relationship. I don't know them, but they feel like they know me. We probably have this with any of those podcasters you listen to. And so that was where it really, the bell really rung for me, was I realized I've got this skill set of oratory and speaking and building trust, and I'm really good at it. And I have this huge database of folks who've invested with us in the past. How can I then bridge the gap doing what I did initially and find someone to partner with? When we did that first deal in the multifamily space, I went out, somebody I had been friends with, had known for over 3 or 4 years. This person was not syndicating when I first knew them. They were just buying, putting all their own equity in and buying multifamily and flipping these properties over a 3-year period. I had convinced them that syndication was the way, but they didn't really get it until they talked with a big private equity guy whom the light bulb went off. This guy's business has exploded since then. But that first deal that I was able to raise money on, I was able to use his background, his track record, his acquisitions team, and we were able to partner and participate in this deal. And we made a killing. He made more money on that deal than he did with his institutional partners. And that added value. So I guess where I'm getting to with this is, when it comes to getting in this game, you just have to figure out what you're good at and what value you can bring. And then you have to give that away without expectation of something in return. This person, as a result of partnering with me on this deal, realized that they could offer significantly more beneficial splits to his investors because he saw that my investors were willing to accept that. And so as a result of that, he's given back to me so much over the years, because that one change probably made him tens, if not $30 or $40 million over the last couple of years. That's how I got here. That's how the podcast started. And that's how the shift came from buying single family homes to getting involved in multifamily.
I'm going to open it up a little bit more on this particular topic. I came from my very first syndication team was a heavy lift operator, but they had transitioned into syndication from wholesaling. They were one of the largest wholesalers here in Phoenix during, I don't know, maybe from 2009 to 2013 or somewhere in that range. I think their first syndication was in 14. At their height of their career or their company success, they were flipping or wholesaling like 700 houses a year. And their communication infrastructure with their investors was very minimal. This is kind of what I want to talk about, because when you're spending 30 days or less holding a property, you're not kind of creating a infrastructure of communication with your investor. You're just basically saying, hey, this is what we can buy for. This is what we can sell for. Give us the money and this is what we're going to give you back. And if you get a track record of doing that, there's no communication because the transaction happens so quickly. And then when you move into syndication, now all of a sudden you're dealing with limited partners that want access, that you're holding for longer periods of time. And they want to know what's going on with the deal, and they want to have specific technology in place and get a newsletter from you and be able to pick up the phone and call you. Did you experience any of this difference in investor mindset when you were transitioning from the single family space to the syndication space?
There was definitely some of this from the investors, those people who were writing the check and they were putting their money into the deal. One big difference was they were used to originally writing a check as debt. meaning they got a first position or a second position or an unsecured loan. And we were paying out 6, 8, 12, 15% interest on those notes. And we were essentially taking the risk. But as a result, we also got all of the upside. So switching over to equity was one piece that was different. The second piece that was different for people coming from that short-term type of a mindset was that they were used to feeling like their money wasn't locked up. They were used to feeling like they were going to get it back. And so it's ironic because it's easier to get somebody to make an initial investment when they're going to have their money back in 3 months or 6 months. It's easier to get that initial investment versus a 5 or 10 year lockup. However, and the other benefit is you get a faster turn time. So they see that success, they're building that trust, they get to share with their friends. So that's the big challenge in syndication is, for example, last year, we raised about $18 to $20 million of equity. We had a lot of success. One deal in particular, we personally, Von Finch alone, had raised about $7.5 million. Great deal. It's going to make great money for folks over the long run. But the interesting thing about that is that they're going to have to wait 3 to 5 years before they see a full return of their capital. And that means over nearly half, a little bit less than half of the investors who invest in that one deal, if they're waiting to see a result, they might be on the sidelines for 1 or 2 or 3 years before they reinvest. If they're really going to wait to see results, you're going to have to wait a lot longer versus when you're doing short-term notes or short-term investments, they can see that return faster. So here's something that's really interesting as you're building your capital raising business or you're building your business as a syndicator. Personally, I want to hold long-term. I want to hold forever because I want to be able to build an asset and gain that long-term appreciation. But it's actually better for your business track record. You'll notice a couple syndicators that have bought and sold property every 18 to 24 months. You notice a big group in Arizona in particular who's
Rise
done that.
Rise 48, they're my friends. They're cool.
One of the reasons they've done that is because it's allowed them to build that track record very, very quickly, which allows them to raise even more money. So this is the trade-off that you have to think about is as a syndicator, you're going to make your money when you sell. So you're incentivized to sell. But the other benefit of selling is that it actually allows you to prove to your investors that you can deliver a return. And what that does is it allows you to grow your business faster. Have you seen that as well?
So there's a lot of interesting contemplations in this particular discussion, because if you're fixing and flipping houses and you're scaling into multifamily, you're doing it because your scalability increases at the commercial real estate level. But if you are doing it with the declaration that you want to create generational wealth, typically you want that legacy asset that you can hold for a long time and leave to your children, or preferably even to your grandchildren, and have them manage the money along the way. But I've talked to a few people that have kind of discussed this particular facet of mind philosophy that basically says, hey, in the process of partnering with a Rise 48 or somebody that's flipping or anybody in the real estate syndication game that is in for 2 to 5 to 7 years, you think that they're not really building legacy wealth because they're just basically flipping their money in and out of deals with all these other trendy limited partners. But
I'm not saying that about specifically the group you mentioned either, because we have deals that we've exited in 12 to 18 months. We have deals that we've exited in a short period of time. I'm saying there's a big benefit for your business as a capital raiser to be able to turn through a deal faster. You're going to attract a different type of investor than you're going to attract if you're holding on to a deal forever.
I got to get this point across, though, because Ray Mazzei, like, I already understood this concept, but when he said it the way he did, he's like, anybody that tells me that if I sell my asset, I'm not creating generational wealth, like, I'll just hang up the phone with them because they're completely wrong. And I think from that perspective, it kind of woke me up to the fact that even if you don't have a legacy asset that you're holding for a long period of time, I'm not saying that this is what you're saying, but I want to emphasize this point. You can be in and out of deals and still be creating generational wealth. Yes, you have to pay tax consequences and capital gains and all that stuff. But there's a real thing that we call the velocity of money. And if you can get in and out, And then perhaps if you're intelligent, put your money into some tax sheltered strategies or trusts or other things, or maybe even start a self-directed retirement account or enhanced qualified retirement plan and use your money in there, or even a infinite banking policy. Take your money and put it in there, shelter it, and then invest in a syndication. Now you're getting into the family office level of wealth creation.
I think all of that's really good, but I think it's important to understand the difference. By all means, there is a portion of your portfolio who should be long-term that is a lower risk and higher stability. If you could flip in and out of stuff all day long, it's a great thing to do, because from a development or a redevelopment standpoint, and you get a higher IRR. You're going to have a higher return on those dollars, as long as you can legitimately take them and move them directly into another deal. If they sit in your bank account for 3 or 6 months in between deals, if you have to pay taxes on those deals and you don't pick up new depreciation, you end up losing some of that velocity. And when you balance it out, if you pay taxes on every exit and you don't have depreciation wipe that out, you end up probably being in a better position holding on to it long term. Now, to be clear, I am not saying I'm against doing short-term deals. We do them all the time. They have a specific place. And the place is in markets that are high appreciation, fast moving markets. Denver's a spot like that. Phoenix is a spot like that. There's markets where you want to be able to get in and out, because the biggest value that you add as an investment firm is through that construction. And a lot of those firms are not well set up to operate for 5-10 years, right? They're set up to be able to quickly stabilize and then sell it off. And I'm not talking about any specific firm. This is in general. This is how the syndication game works. But that's when you start seeing how family offices invest and what they're looking for. They're typically more focused on long-term stability over growth. And so that's what's so key, is you got to know who your investors are, because I could bring a deal today that's phenomenal for a family office that can write me a $10 million check and they just want to park money somewhere. And my current investors who are used to growth, they're going to look at that and they're going to say, this isn't a good deal. And it's not that it's not a good deal. It's just a different deal. Mm-hmm. Have you found that? Do you kind of have those different types of investors in your portfolio?
Oh, yeah. Well, not necessarily in my portfolio, but in just my dealings with people on the Capital Raiser show. And particularly recently, I've been hanging out with a lot of the family offices and kind of seeing how their mindset is all about preservation of capital instead of, at least some of them. I don't want to define family offices in any one way, but some of the people that I've talked to have very different mindsets than limited partners, that have very different mindsets than co-GPs, that have very different mindsets from JV partners that all take down multifamily and other commercial real estate assets. But yeah, like you said, man, you got to know exactly who you're trying to attract into your deal. And maybe even, here's another thing that we've talked about on the show, is instead of like being all about acquisitions and let me see how I can make something pencil and then take it out to your investor database, find out what it is that your investor database, the one that you currently have, wants, and then go find a deal that fits their parameters instead of trying to force what you think pencils down their throat. So this is another concept that
I think that's so smart. When I talk to new up and coming capital raisers, Ruben, what I often say is, if you're brand new to the game and you're not super confident in your ability to bring a deal, maybe you can create a fund of funds and you can raise some money into it. Or maybe you can get a co-GP partnership that is comfortable with you bringing only a small amount of money, small is relative, but I'm saying very, very small, being like less than $500,000 or definitely less than $250,000. When you're in that kind of place, I feel like one of the best things that I think somebody can do is they go out and they find a deal with somebody that they know, like, and trust, a sponsor that they've done due diligence on, that they know is good at what they do, and go pimp that deal out. In other words, go take that deal and go and sell that to your investors. Say, this is not something I'm involved in. I'm not getting paid on this in any way, but this is something that we're looking for deals. And because we haven't had one, I just want to put this in front of you. We know these people. I like them. I'm considering investing myself, and see what people's interests are. Because if all of a sudden you sell $1 million worth of people into this deal, one, maybe you can actually find a way to get involved in that. I'm not saying you can or can't, but it's possible that you could. But also, you're going to have a heck of a lot more confidence when you go to go do your own deal in the future. I love it. I think one of the best ways we work with co-GPs, we work with capital raisers, if you will, people who have existing networks and they want to get involved in the deal and add value. We put together fund of funds so they can participate in those. People bring their own. I think this really is like a team sport. I think the risk is you really got to know who you're working with, because there's some bad things that happen. I mean, I've had experiences myself, I'm sure you have, where you get involved with somebody too early and they don't really do what they say they were going to do. And so it's important to partner with the right kind of people. So what do you look for when you're trying to partner with somebody? What's those things that you're always looking for?
I was just talking about this on a mastermind earlier today, man. One of the things that I'm really focused on is what is the investor retention rate of the sponsor and what is the track record of them? It's not necessarily the returns. So if somebody has an investor database that reinvests into their next deal at an 80% clip or higher, that means that the investor experience is amazing. And then you have these other guys that seem like they're very spiritually aligned. They love the residents, they throw them parties and send anniversary cards, but then their communication infrastructure with the limited partner is just absolutely horrendous and nobody knows what's going on with the money and they don't have an investor portal or they have some other deficiencies or they can't be reached on by phone or they're very poor at calling people back. So just because somebody is spiritually aligned and loves to be very good at acquisitions and taking care of the residents doesn't necessarily mean that they're good at communication. So that is an indication of the investor experience. That's one of the most important parts for me. That, and like, I want to listen to my gut as I'm deciding whether or not to work with people. And I, of course, get, being the host of the Capital Raiser Show, I get a bazillion people asking me to raise capital for them. And unfortunately, I'm not a private equity firm that can just stroke a check to everybody. So I have to be very selective. And I want to be working with somebody that's got like around 2,000 units or above in one specific market or is very good at one particular thing. So those are some of the things that I kind of look at. But, you
I
know,
think one of the big things to really watch out for is you want to talk to people that they've worked with. If you can't, you shouldn't work with them, period. Here's why. Because you should never be a situation where you're under the gun to make a decision about a partnership. Because what I can say from my experience, without going into too much detail, is that sometimes people, they've got great experience, they've done a bunch of stuff, but they're not so good at communication and your investors are going to be upset. And then you're kind of trying to backtrack your way out of it. It's not good for you. It hurts your reputation. And it really will make you question, how do you know that you can trust people? I think the other big thing that you should find out ahead of time is what kind of transparency is the sponsor willing to share?
Yeah.
You know, I have a deal that I worked on in the past and it is really a shame. It's somebody that you guys all would know, and it's a bummer to work with somebody and have them be so known, but also being very not willing to share key information, like balance sheet, like understanding what's happening at a property level, sharing clear financials. You want to find out in advance with the folks you're working with, if you ask for a balance sheet for the entity that your investors are invested in, that you can get it, that you can see the debt terms, that you can see where financials are at. So these are things that you want to ask ahead of time when you're kind of in that courting stage, when you're in that kind of dating stage, you're not married, you're not in yet. Maybe you think you like each other, but you want to find out like, hey, if we're not going to be involved every day and we're not making decisions, or maybe we are, but if we're interested in looking at this information, or we want to have an analysis run to so that we can answer questions effectively for our investors, or we want to know how much cash is in the bank because the market's shifting, you want to make sure that you're in a position where you can do that. And any good sponsor who is trustworthy is not going to obfuscate the information. They're not going to withhold information or make it difficult for you to get that.
Well, it's very clear and obvious that we have a ton of things to talk about. We're not going to have the time. I am very curious about one thing, though, because I know that we could talk about personal development and mindset. I think that would be a really fun conversation here. And that pertains to capital raising and acquisitions and being a good sponsor. But I'm very curious, just like in terms of your business model, before I take you through the lightning round, what is it that you are currently acquiring and what is it that you want to over the next 3 to 5 years, maybe?
Yeah. So we've got a couple different things. And if you like what we're talking about here, we talk a lot more about investing related topics on the Investor Mindset Show, but you guys should definitely check that out if you've enjoyed today's conversation. But our primary focus is on multifamily. Every deal that we're involved with, we're in kind of a controlling decision-making type of a role, which means that we're in a place where we're sponsoring deals, we're going out directly acquiring deals, or we're having folks who bring us opportunities. And then we typically are putting together majority of the capital. We're fortunate to have built a machine where we've got investors who do invest with us over and over again. They trust us. So we're looking for multifamily deals. We're looking in Dallas, Denver. We're looking in Central Florida, North Carolina. We have assets in a few other markets, but those are our primary focuses right now, with Denver being a key focus. And what's interesting is right now we're finding a real strong value proposition on the smaller multifamily in the 40 to 80 unit type range. So we're seeing some really great deals here locally in Denver. They have some redevelopment. There's some good cash flow, but there's also some good appreciation that's built in, and you know, all underwritten super conservatively. So we like that. We have a preferred equity fund, which means preferred equity is like a second mortgage, but for equity in a real estate offering. So we have a fund where we'll actually place capital with other operators and into deals that we're operating. What's nice about that is we end up having the ability to force a sale or remove a manager if, for example, somebody's a bad actor or they're not operating that property well. And we're in a more secure position. So we see that kind of similar to a mortgage broker. We go out and we source really great deals from great operators and we help get those closed. We're also in pretty deep into some other new alternative strategies that are real estate adjacent. But I won't talk about those today.
I want to hear. Come on. You got to share at least a little bit, unless they're like 506Bs. But if they're 506Cs, you want to hear about them.
Once they're available, I think it's going to really play well in the real estate space with some real estate private equity firms getting involved. And that's kind of where we're at. If you're interested in finding out more, you know, I definitely encourage you to hit me up on LinkedIn or, you know, go to vonfinch.com and register and just shoot me an email, because we're looking to partner with the right kind of people. I've helped mentor and coach a lot of people up who have been growing, and I'd love the opportunity to build a relationship. That's really what I think it's all about.
Yeah. If anyone calls you, it'll probably be a co-GP. We get a lot of that on this in our audience here. Tell me about the preferred equity. Is that done through a fund? And if you could explain, because you mentioned it as a mortgage, but I understand it to be more mezzanine debt is of a mortgage, but preferred equity.
We're placing equity. It's taxed as equity. What's nice about it is it creates a preferred return. So typically the way that works is we're actually in a preferred position, meaning we're getting paid back a return of our capital and a return on our capital prior to the sponsor or any other equity being paid. So the benefit there is typically the way that we structure it is we have a 20% buffer, meaning there's 20% of common equity that sits behind us, which puts us in a really secure position. And what I like about it is we can create a 12 to 14 or a 12 to 16% return while having 20% of equity behind us because of that structure and because we're writing a much larger check. So it puts us in a pretty unique position to be able to get involved in these deals and create a better risk-adjusted return for investors. So we've really seen that there's kind of a need. People are not having enough capital to close because of the lack of liquidity or because of lower loan to value. So because of that, we decided to put this together, and a lot of our more institutional family office clients were really excited about it.
I bet. Okay, very cool, man. Let's jump into the lightning round. I'm going to ask you a set of questions here. Well, let's start with this one. This is one of my favorites. Best vacation you've ever taken.
Man, I've gone so many great places, but I think one of my favorites was after I shut down one of those startups back. I moved from Boulder, Colorado to Medellin, Colombia to study Spanish and just bankroll a bunch of money off of Airbnbs I had. So I was just hanging out there. It was like a 3-month long vacation and one of my favorite spots. I didn't do any of the crazy party things that people usually do down there, but just the people and the food, and it was a beautiful place.
Fantastic. Favorite book of any kind?
One of my favorite books is The Go-Giver. It's really a philosophy that's come to really represent kind of how I think about doing business, really about building relationships, giving value first, really coming from this place of like, how can I be of service and value? And knowing that it comes around, maybe not directly, but in general, living from that place.
Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
There's a lot of moments. I'd say one moment most recently was about 3 years ago. I lost somebody really close to me suddenly in a car accident. Nothing nefarious, just black ice, and they passed away. And that moment, when I heard that, I realized, well, life's never gonna be the same for two reasons. One, you gotta appreciate every day you have. And the second, because you can't expect that your job or company is gonna keep paying you. So it actually created this huge momentum towards building out that passive income stream, towards building out something that I knew that I'd be taken care of, because for 3 or 4 months after this happened, I mean, I was out of commission. I was in a really dark down place when you lose somebody that's that close. And it really makes you understand why it's so important to build out these portfolios and to, yeah, be focused on growth, but also be sure that you're gonna have something there to take care of you.
Wow. All right, so short answer on this question, best way to raise capital from your perspective?
I think the best way is it's all relationship based. And so you just gotta choose how you're gonna build those relationships. For me, it was media, speaking, it's teaching, it's connecting, it's building trust at scale. And so I would just say, find the way that you best connect. If you're a writer, if you're a speaker, whatever that is.
All right, a few more questions. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
I think so. I think just having this understanding that there's really, whether you believe in God or the universe or whatever words you want to use to represent that, for me, what I found is that I'm connected to something greater. And because of that, it's created so many opportunities for me to connect with people, regardless of what their religious belief is. Just understanding we're pretty much all thinking the same thing. It's just a little bit of a different brand.
All right. What do you love best about salsa dancing?
I think my favorite thing is I like doing things that I'm really bad at and getting good at them.
Okay.
And when you start salsa dancing as a guy, you are the one who's leading. So you have to know what you're doing. So for months and months, even if you're taking lessons multiple times a week like I was, because I always get a great coach whenever I'm learning something new, that it took a couple months and then all of a sudden it just clicks. And the secret to salsa dancing is that you know you're good at salsa dancing when you can dance with any woman and she feels like she's good, regardless of whether she's actually good at salsa.
Wow.
So that's my favorite thing, is I feel like that's true about a lot of things in life, is that when you're really good at something, you can make people who have no idea what you're talking about understand it. That's how you know you really got a good understanding.
Great answer on that. Okay, so have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience yourself?
Yep, I have had some miracle type spiritual healing moments. And the short answer of it is a friend of mine had his friend coming in to work with Oprah and Maria Shriver. And he was coming back from Richard Branson's island, and he ended up staying at our house for a couple of weeks, and he did some healing on me. And I went from having super painful headaches that I had for 2 or 3 years. I went from being in pain every day for those 3 years to miraculously not having any of that pain anymore. It was a life changer. It was a game changer.
Fascinating.
Longer story for sure.
Last question. What impact? So this is brought to you by Shannon Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
Impact's a really big thing for me. I feel like one of the things that I learned was, and one of the reasons I've been lucky, is just being able to be around some successful people. I grew up, like I said, in a pretty rough and tumble type environment without a lot of that belief. And so one of the biggest impacts I want to leave is leaving people believing in themselves, believing that they can do it, believing they can put in the time, effort, and energy, that it's possible for them no matter where they come from. And sometimes because you come from the bottom, it makes it easier for you. So whatever your limiting belief is, it's actually, if you flip it, it can be exactly the reason why you can succeed. So a lot of the impact and legacy that I'm leaving in the world is really around education, youth, and helping people change the way that they think.
Fantastic. All right, cool, man. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Razor Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions and our sponsors, Good Egg Investments, Syndication Pro, Apartment Educators, the Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Check out their programs. Get $1,000 off at CapitalRazorShow.com. Steven, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
If you're interested in getting involved in what we do, if you're interested in partnering or you have a fund, if you're interested in connecting, or if there's something that we can do to help, head over to LinkedIn or Instagram at Steven.Pesavento and shoot me a DM. Send me a message. Someone from me or my team will get back in touch and let me know that you listen to this show and how I can help.
Cool, Matt. I want to ask you real quick. I think I recall listening to one show that you did with Chris Voss, the negotiator from Split the Difference. Can you mention anything about that before we wrap it up here?
Well, it's the most listened to episode we've had, 100,000 views or something like that on one of the videos. But it was an incredible experience. It was actually right after that tragedy that I talked about that I interviewed him. So I really pulled myself together for one of the most important and hardest interviews I've ever had. But what was cool about it was I had an opportunity to actually engage Chris in a hostage negotiation, a mock hostage negotiation. And as I said, I was already going through some tough times. But what was so fascinating on that is that we did this drill called 60 Seconds or She Dies. And Chris so effectively leverages the skills that he teaches that just using the tone of his voice, he was able to essentially shut my brain off, to just lock me up. And you can watch me just fall apart negotiating against one of the best negotiators. So definitely go check that out. Chris Voss, Investor Mindset on YouTube.
Awesome, man. All right. Any last words of wisdom for the scaling or aspiring multifamily syndicator or capital raiser as they grow in their business?
Yeah, man. Just go take action. Find some great people to work with that you share their values, build a relationship, add value to them, and everything will shake out in the end.
Well, this has been a blast, man. Thanks for coming on the show, dude. With that, I'll let you go, bro.
Thanks. Take care.